Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is lawyer Bob Nersessian, who's about to argue a gambling case in front of the United States Supreme Court. He's a frequent visitor to the show, and we'll be talking to him shortly. I received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com concerning the double-up process in video poker. The player wanted to know if it was a good idea. Basically, on the machines when you double up, when their double-up feature is turned on, these are winning hands. You'll have a 50-50 chance to either double your bet or go down to zero on this particular bet. On a personal basis, I consider it a waste of time. I'm only playing games where I have a better than 100% bet, everything included. So making an additional bet that is only 100% actually lowers my EV and cuts down on my hourly win rate. If this feature is turned on a machine where I wish to play, I'll ask to have the feature turned off if it feels appropriate to ask for those kind of favors in that casino. There are some circumstances, though, where playing this 100% bet makes sense. Now, I'm limiting the discussion to cases where you have the edge, because that's what this show is all about. Some casinos keep track of your time of play in addition to coin in. Harrah's properties do this, although I'm not exactly sure why. For some reason, if you have a theoretical on a day for, say, $5,000, which is a lot of play, they would rather you spent at least 4 hours earning that theoretical than do it in 2 hours. I don't know why, but they do. So waiting, so using the double up feature keeps you active on something with, it doesn't hurt your long-term expected loss. Now, waiting 20 seconds between plays accomplishes the same thing at lower variance. About 15 years ago, a guy I knew was playing $5 triple play, 9-6 jacks or better, at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. I'll call this guy Joe. At the time, these machines would offer the double-up feature only on W2G hands that were less than $20,000. In this particular game, the most frequent W2Gs were a straight flush, which was $1,250, or two four-of-a-kinds on the same hand, which is also $1,250, although you usually got something on the third hand, probably a three-of-a-kind or a full house. Joe had the philosophy that it was smart business-wise to tip at least $5 on every W2G, but he felt tipping $5 on such a low-level W2G was a waste, so he doubled up twice. So three-fourths of the time, his W2G would get reduced to zero, and one-fourth of the time, he'd get a W2G jackpot in the $5,000 to $6,000 range. On these, he'd collect and pay a $5 tip. So this procedure reduced his average effective tip to a buck and a quarter per W2G without the casino employees knowing he was such a cheap bastard. If he had actually tipped a buck and a quarter, they would not have liked it, but he did the same thing without letting them know. If he was dealt quad, he'd get $1,875, I think it is, and he'd double up once, and then he'd tip the $5 on that if he got it. There are some casinos that reward you for getting W2Gs. Usually this is in terms of drawing tickets of some sort. Now, Dottie's in Nevada, there are 15 machine outlets, smoky dumps, but they have a promotion where the more W2Gs you get, the better. Other casinos have had similar promotions in the past. If you had that and you got a $300 jackpot, it might well make sense to double up twice, so that one-fourth of the time you get a $1,200 W-2G and whatever this bonus is, and three-fourths of the time you get nothing. Obviously, there are IRS considerations for the W-2G, and the state taxes differ by state. In some states, you can write off all your W-2Gs against your winnings, against your losses, and in some states, you can't. So you need to keep that in effect. You need to account for that. But it's possible this can be a smart play in certain circumstances. Using the double up feature adds a lot to your variance. So you need to have a lot more cash on hand if you're going to voluntarily doubling up your big hands. So now, Munch, you're not a video poker player. Do you have anything to add on this subject?
Well, yeah. I mean, the other aside from your friend's cheapness in the tip department, I would think that this would speed up your play a lot, right? When you have a W-2G, doesn't that halt things and take time out of your actual playing? So time is money, and if you can avoid, you know, 3 out of 4 W-2Gs, aren't you getting that many more hands per hour?
Yeah, and on that particular machine, it's probably that casino was maybe 5 minutes per W-2G, and you might get them once an hour or something. So, yeah, it is time you save. Not a great amount, but when we're talking about $5 or $1.25, yeah, something in that range.
I mean, he's probably making more money by playing the extra hands than he is saving in the tips that he's saving.
That's a good point. I never considered that, and I think you're right.
The other thing is that the double up feature obviously would help you. The casinos tend to comp you more when you have a loss. So actually that's sort of a form of loss rebate. But if there was a loss rebate as well, you want volatility, you want variance. So the double up feature obviously could help you out a lot in those situations as well, where it's costing you nothing, but it's adding to your variance, which is, you know, what you want.
It's costing you nothing in EV. It may cost you bunches today. Or you may win bunches today, but so
yeah. But we don't look at what happens today. We look at what happens at the end of our lives. You know, your EV converges. Your actual win converges on your EV by the end of your life, whether you double up or not.
Agreed. And you and I lead our lives that way. A few of our listeners have trouble with that concept.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And actually, to your point about Harrah's, I think this is another case of them instituting a rule that they don't really understand. But my suspicion is that the thought behind it was somebody who understood math realizes that it makes a big difference if somebody lost their $5,000 over 4 hours or over one spin. And, rather than look at what the actual EV the player gave the casino, they're trying to put an arbitrary, you know, well, let's look at the amount of minutes he spent, which is the wrong way to go about it.
But it is Harrah's.
right.
All right. Now, on a somewhat related subject to variance and risk, we received another email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com concerning the risk of ruin feature on the computer software Video Poker for Winners. Now, I get a piece out of it if you buy it. But that aside, if you don't have the software and you're a video poker player, you should get it. There are several video poker computer software products. They are all different. They all have extra features that the other ones don't. And each of them are a very small part of the money you're risking every day when you go into the casino. So basically, you should have all of them. Now, with that commercial out of the way. Now, this particular player... I lost my place. All right. Now, risk of ruin is a long-run bankroll consideration and is a critical consideration for gamblers of all stripes. The player was playing $9-6 jacks or better with an effective slot club rate of 1.42%. Don't know how he got the 1.42%. I assume it's an estimated monetized figure, including comps, mailers, current promotions, etc., but I don't know exactly how he got it. Now, he was willing to face a 5% chance of going broke, and the software says he needs a bankroll of $11,800 to do this. He wants to know how much more he needs if his wife also plays on the same bankroll? This is a good question. It is easy to answer, and once you hear the answer, you go, oh, okay, good. It's really simple. But if before you hear the answer, it doesn't make sense. Now, the way risk of ruin works is that it assumes you're going to be playing forever and ever, amen, perhaps 400 hours a week for the next 300 years. Obviously, you're not going to be playing that way forever, nor will two people, nor will 22 people. The strange feature about having more money than is required for risk of ruin bankroll is that any number of people can be playing on the same bankroll and still be within the 5% risk of ruin, or 1% or 10% or whatever other figure you plugged in. This feature of bankrolls and risk of ruin is one reason it often makes sense to gamble in teams rather than as individuals. Munchkin, this idea of multiple people playing on the same bankroll carries over well into the table game area, yes?
Yeah, it's a really good idea, you know, for blackjack players, because if you have two players and they each have $10,000 and they're going to win X dollars per hour, if they put their money together and have a $20,000 bankroll, rather than winning twice as much, they're going to win four times as much.
Assuming they're betting based on a $20,000.
Yeah, assuming, right.
And they're betting 1% of their edge or some whatever their formula is.
Well, whatever percentage they were betting before, whatever percentage of their bankroll they were betting, it quadruples rather than doubles. But one thing that's sort of important to note, each hand of video poker, if you have two people or 10 people playing video poker, those are all independent events. It doesn't mean if you're at a blackjack table that you can play two hands of the same amount of money and they wouldn't count.
They're going to be correlated because the dealer is going to get a blackjack against both of you.
Right. Exactly. If you have two players at two different tables, it's fine, but not two players at the same table.
Very good. Although it's not a perfect correlation. It's
right. But the risk of ruin figure would be different.
Yes.
If they're at the same table.
All right. Let's talk to Bob Nersessian. Bob Nersessian is the author of Beat the Player and is the best-known attorney fighting on the player's behalf against casinos, gaming control boards, and often other governmental agencies as well. He has more appearances on Gambling with an Edge than any non-host, and we're happy to have him again. Bob Nersessian, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. And apparently I've been around this stuff way too long because I'm pretty sure I understood what you guys were just talking about.
Oh, well, we didn't even slow it down for you. This is good. Good. Now, you're about to argue a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the case, let's talk about you. This is pretty impressive. Are you going to get a new suit and a new haircut?
I don't have any hair to get cut. And
you could trim your beard.
I could, but then I wouldn't be quite as swarthy. that is a word, right?
Yeah, it's also a tautology, but okay.
Well, thanks for checking out my proclivities, so, and yes, I will.
Now, at the Supreme Court level, you can assume that they've read your briefs and with the help of their clerk are pretty up to date on the issues.
And probably about 30 other briefs, too.
And when you make your oral presentation, they can interrupt you anytime they damn well please and pepper you with all sorts of questions that may or may not seem friendly. Does this excite you or scare the heck out of you?
Well, actually, interesting question. I don't frighten anymore, even when people are hitting me about the head. So it doesn't frighten me. The whole thing excites me on a personal level very much. I mean, analogizing to baseball, this is like the show. As to whether or not, or as to the oral argument, it hasn't even been determined if I'm going to be doing it yet. When you get to the Supreme Court level, people come out of the woodwork and you approach the Supreme Court as a team. Now, I guess functionally and correctly so, I would be the leader of that team, but my goal is to do the best I can for my client. And this being my first time in that venue, I may well not be the best person to be doing oral argument.
When is this going to go? When will this happen?
Probably November. So it's not as soon as Bob led us to believe a second ago. Okay. There's a lot of briefing in the interim, and as to the other briefs and that they'll be reading and stuff, the issues that is that it, the issue that is being presented or issues, I did it again. I'm sorry for banging on the table, ladies and gentlemen. The issues are of a nature that there are going to be on both sides probably a lot of what are called amicus briefs by interested parties on the outside who want to weigh in on the issue as well.
And so you have to be familiar with all those arguments as well.
Well, that's a great question, and I think the answer is, when you say familiar, when you stack up those amicus briefs, you're going to be looking at War and Peace, and no, I am not going to have them memorized.
But they can ask you about anything and any of them.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, there's only so many different ways you can come at an issue. And from what I understand, I'd only be getting questions from 8 of the members because I understand one of them doesn't ask questions. But I'd love to see a question from him because he's actually one of my favorites. So it is a daunting and intimidating situation we find ourselves in, but I am looking forward to it too.
You, before we went on the air, you were saying that this is not a really a big deal gambling-wise, but a big deal legal-wise. So can we talk about exactly what exactly the case is about?
Well, the case is about two Advantage gamblers who are returning from San Juan. It's all public record. They're returning with just shy of $100,000 between the two of them. It's been a circle trip to Atlantic City, then San Juan, and a return to Las Vegas where they have homes. They got on the plane in San Juan and they carried their money openly. As I've said on this show before, is probably the best way to do it if you are forced to carry cash and you are a gambler, and carry support documents to the extent you can too. And they had those as well. They were told when they got on the plane that there might be some more questions in Las Vegas, but the way the DEA works, the information apparently was put out over whatever their system is, and a DEA strike force agent or task force agent in Atlanta got news of this, and from my perspective and in my opinion, they saw an opportunity to take that money in Atlanta, where these people were only there for a short period of time. And indeed, they were approached at the boarding gate getting on their connection when he showed up and took their money and claimed that largely because of the volume of money, that money was drug proceeds, thinking that only drug couriers would carry that kind of money, perhaps. But in truth, we all know that gamblers are often in a position where they have to have that kind of money on them. And he did this over some very interesting stuff, too. I mean, these gamblers had had with them their logs. They had with them books to study up on various games in case they showed up wherever they went or whatever or what have you. And all of that was ignored. The money was grabbed. Allegedly a dog hit on one of the bags, but not on the other patron's bag or not on the other gambler's bag. And he took it from both of them. And that dog hit itself is suspect under a lot of case law because you can't find $100 bills in America that have been circulated to any degree that aren't already tainted with drugs. So the case itself, the gambler sued the agent here in Nevada.
Him personally or
yes.
The DEA?
Well, you can't really sue the DEA.
Okay.
There might be ways that you could, but the way the law is set up is you sue the individual agents or police officers or what have you when it comes to constitutional violations rather than the government agencies. By definition, almost, the DEA cannot commit a tort because their policies and procedures say, here's what you must do, and you must follow the Constitution. So any agent who would violate someone's constitutional rights is acting outside of the authority of the agency, so you sue the agent directly. But the agency and the United States government turns around and stands behind the guy and pays for the attorneys and everything else, which in this case is also most curious, and I find this really... I can't understand this. In this court, this agent has one of the most renowned private law firms in this country, and we as taxpayers are paying for his defense as well as paying for an entire United States Attorney's office. I would hope that the government could hire attorneys that could handle this and not have to go out and pay extra money to other people to represent the government's interests, but apparently that's not the way it's working.
Wow. So, but now so, they have got their money back, right?
Yes, I participated in that, and we did get the money back. This is the damaged suit for the emotional distress, the lost interest for the 6 months it took the money back, the attorney's fees that were expended to get the money back, because the police officer from the plaintiff's perspective here should have never taken it. And I forgot, we didn't get around to what the actual issue is. The issue is, can you sue this Atlanta DEA agent where the plaintiffs reside, that being in Nevada, or do you have to sue him, even though the plaintiff's connection with Atlanta was not even on a street in Atlanta, only on an international airport to walk from one plane to another, and that's where they get their money stolen? Are they forced to go all the way back to Georgia to sue him, or can they sue him where he should have known the injury would have occurred, which is where they land with no money? One of the things that is alleged here and that is in the opinions that have occurred to date is this agent was so Machiavellian with $100,000. The young lady who was one of the people who had tens of thousands of dollars taken from her said, please, sir, could you leave me enough for cab fare so I'm not stranded at the airport? And his answer was no. Essentially, and if you got any pennies in your pocket, you better give those to me too.
Nice guy.
Yeah.
So we're actually likely to have Bob on the show a couple times before November. So I think we're going to be hearing about this in the future as well.
Well, I just found out today that I'm your mode guest, so
that's it. And be nice to us and we'll invite you back, I promise.
It's the other way around. When our other guests fail, we have to call them up and go,
oh, that's what it is. All right, good. All right, so Indian casinos, players never win in Indian casinos, is that right?
I understand gambling-wise, they can win quite often and
no,
quite
lawsuits.
Well.
No, lawsuits. Has anybody ever successfully sued an Indian casino?
Well, money's been collected from Indian casinos. The way the whole thing is set up, and I actually tell people, my clients, et cetera, that all your civil rights, everything else, to a large degree, it's a crapshoot, and the best odds are that they've been flushed down the toilet. You don't have any of those rights. Recently, I have a case. It's published on Lexis and Westlaw out of the Arizona District Court, federal court in Arizona, where we have, at least to this stage, successfully kept in some Indian defendants because they participated in a conspiracy with local state agents as well, which sort of took them out of the Indian pool, if you will, and made them state actors, not Indian actors. And the judge has agreed to this point, and that case is going forward. There are other cases where if you don't have that, if it's strictly if there are no state agents involved and you find even your money just plain taken by the security at the casino, or you're put in a back room and roughed up, or you're accused of cheating or what have you, you don't have the same civil rights that you have against non-Indian casinos. An exception that I'm not sure how it actually works out this well as of yet is you may have some protection if you have if you are participating in an Indian casino that is run by a management company or that is operated in partnership with a non-Indian entity, for example, Harrah's Rincon.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but you're not going to, you know, the Rincon tribe, you probably would have no recourse against them or their personnel, but you might be able to protect your rights by looking to Harrah's, who has put their name on the top, is getting some of the profits, and has management responsibilities, and can't really assert the Indian sovereign status that prevents the law, other lawsuits.
So you said that you've gotten money from some, but do you mean you've gotten money returned that was confiscated, or you've actually won a case against a...
Or settled.
Won or settled a case.
There's been one or more cases where I have settled, but I got to tell you, they settle much cheaper than any other cases would, because you know that you are only limited to proceeding in Indian court on Indian land against the very people who own and run the court. So
does it vary at all by state? Or, I mean, are some states different than others, or it's all the same if you're in an Indian?
To date, from what I've seen, it's uniform. There is a statute out there that speaks to some states that are supposedly not entitled to sovereign immunity. Their jurisdiction has been ceded to the states. I have not seen that tested in a gambling perspective as of yet. I also haven't had anything in those states. So,
do you know which states those are?
You've just asked me a question that is the same as what color underwear am I wearing? I have no idea.
Okay.
I knew it sometime, like when I put them on this morning or when I read the statute, but there's like six states.
We're getting into the too much information stage. Let's change topics here. Now, smartphones typically allow you to either audio record or visually record stuff that's going on around you. Now, let's talk about recording police officers and or casino security guards when something's happening.
Okay, there's three states, there are three states that have now made it illegal without permission to film a police officer. Those states are of the very nature as the same as the color of my underwear. I don't know which ones they are. Nevada is not one of them.
Let me just... preface this. On my blog, I had posted a link to one of those Know Your Rights sites that had an article about recording police. And in that article, they said there are 38 states where it is legal. And of the ones where there isn't specifically a law that says you can, including Nevada and California, they have ruled that those are public conversations and you can record a police officer.
Right.
Even though they don't have a law that says...
Well, the three states I'm talking about, and I'm coming at this from a different context, you as a public citizen see police officers doing their job on the street or allegedly doing their job or even failing to do their job. You're an outside person. You're not the person who is interacting with the police. In those three states, it's illegal to pull out your camera and start filming them. Public officials doing their job in public, and those states have seen fit to say, no, you can't record them. The curious thing is, the only reason I could think of passing anything that approaches that law is you want the police to be able to lie and get off.
Right.
Because there's no other reason to prevent it.
So let's not talk about those three states. Most of the states aren't among those three. Now, so you're recording a police on the job and recording casino security officers on the job. Is this similar? Are they different?
Well, before we get to that, I just want to say, okay, I'm a gambler. I'm driving down the highway with $50,000 in my suitcase.
We're back to the cash.
Right, we're back to the cash, and I get pulled over by one of these, you know, do you mind if we search your car, sir? You know, you were driving erratically or whatever BS they make up, which they do. So before the cop comes to my...
They don't even have to make up stuff, Richard. they can always find something. There is a case out there that says that the discreet air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror is an obstruction of vision that allows to pull over, and that provides the reasonable suspicion. And everybody knows that those things aren't blocking your vision. There are a ton of cases that deal with an alleged, because many of them are denied, license plate light that was either flickering or not lit.
Right, right.
Okay? Against your reflective plate. So, yeah, they can always come up with something.
Okay. So I get pulled over and I turn on my cell phone, the video or the audio, before the cop comes to the window. So, A, do I need to tell him I'm recording it? Should I tell him I'm recording it?
It depends on where you are, and I can't differentiate all of those, but I would say record it and tell him you're recording it. Let him see it or show him, okay? And as to the other question.
And if he says, turn it off, turn that off. Do I have to turn it off?
If you're in one of the three states, yeah.
Right, but if I'm not, if I'm in Nevada or California.
No.
I don't have to turn it off.
You don't have to turn it off.
But he can arrest you if you don't.
Yeah.
Well, he can arrest you because he doesn't like the color of your hair. It's an unconstitutional arrest, but he has the power of arrest.
Yes.
Still, in the next lead-in question that was raised by Richard's circumstances, also, never consent to that search. We have instances that have had and involved planted cocaine on someone's vehicle in this very state, and I'm going to take it one step further, and if you'll allow me to digress, because I am so offended by this. The guy went to jail for the cocaine. Ugh. Subsequently, it was determined, oh, wait, it was planted. Okay? And the police officer that planted it said, I planted it because I was testing the dog I was training as to whether or not he could spot it. And I forgot to tell the other officers at the scene that the planted cocaine was there.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah. it went all the way to the Nevada Supreme Court. And the cop, if I remember the decision correctly, was found. Nobody was found to have done anything wrong. The person who was put in jail had no action against them for the planted cocaine.
And for the time he spent in jail.
Right.
He had no
recourse.
Wow.
So, you want to... So, if they can search your car, and we know... If you let them search their car, and we know in Nevada that this has happened, you can end up with cocaine stuck between your seat cushions in the back, looking at a police officer 5 minutes later, holding up that little baggie of white powder and saying, you're going to jail, and you've never even seen cocaine in your life.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you never consent, although if they insist, they're...
Well, if they... What do you mean insist?
I don't know.
Well, okay, so here's what happens often, right? They say, we're going to walk our dog around your vehicle, and then they make the dog bark, and they say, that gives us probable cause. Now, does that mean they can search it immediately, or do they now have to go get a warrant still?
I believe they have to still go get a warrant. But
right, but they try to talk you into saying, now that we have probable cause, we can go get a warrant, you know? But mm-hmm. So my thought was,
well, they try to talk you into letting the search go on even without the dog coming up.
Right.
You know, spend a day on YouTube, watch this stuff. I don't think I've spent a whole day, but I'm just continuously amazed. On the other stuff we were talking about earlier, Bob, the Supreme Court argument will be much like, and I know I'm just switching right
okay.
out of nowhere.
You're our longest standing guest. You have certain rights here.
It'll be much like arguing in a circuit court of appeals, and I have lots of experience at that as well. But I've also got a gambler case going in the third, in front of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals next month that I'm doing oral argument on. That's New Jersey. So I guess I'm going national.
Oh, is this the stolen ace case?
Yes.
Ah, I was going to ask you about that, actually, but obviously nothing's happened if you haven't gone to the court, gone to court.
Well,
yet.
One of the things that happened is I've stepped in for the appeal. A different attorney had the earlier the trial court litigation, and the judge dismissed that case. Curiously, one of his findings, if I recall correctly, was that there was no contract.
When you put $100 on your in your betting circle and they're dealing cards, that's not a contract?
Well, I didn't say it wasn't a contract. I said a judge said it wasn't a contract.
For our listeners who don't know, this is a case of somebody who bet $6,000, was it?
No, they were looking to pull $6,000 back after the. It was like $3,700.
I thought that was his EV.
Well, goodness. Just make me look like an idiot.
I think he bet $7,000. He bet $7,000, received an ace as his first card, and then the boss said, no, you
they
get no
the
action.
Ace back.
Took
and,
the ace back, yeah.
And later in the day, when he came back to try and adjust it with the management, they tackled him, handcuffed him, threw him in a back room. because apparently when you protest about mistreatment, it is disorderly conduct.
Actually, this brings up a question somebody sent us about Atlantic City. In jurisdictions where they are not allowed to bar you for counting cards, like New Jersey or Missouri, can they bar you for other forms of advantage play, like hole carding?
New Jersey is a very odd place because one construction of the case law in New Jersey would be they can bar you for that time, even for disorderly conduct, but you cannot receive a permanent bar. Okay.
So when you say bar you for that time, what does that mean? For the night?
For the night, for 24 hours, for half a day, until the shift changes. Nobody knows what it means. Okay. One case seems to suggest it's 24 hours, but they have to tell you you can't come back for 24 hours. Otherwise, I mean, like I said, there's no real rule in New Jersey, and everything's open to interpretation. I know that the casinos generally think that if you are legitimately barred for disorderly conduct or breaking the law, that you cannot come back ever. And courts have said that's not exactly the case, but nobody has defined where the break point is such that any of us should feel safe about it.
There was a case about this woman was barred from a casino because they said she was a hooker. Do you know anything about this?
You mean the one that I'm litigating?
I don't know. Is that the color of your underwear?
Yeah, I know something about it.
Oh, good. It's inquiring minds want to know.
What do they want to know? It was okay.
The whole subject is:
Did she get paid? That's the, you know, I mean, you're suing, right?
Well, the case is in litigation. The allegations are that she was not a hooker and was not hooking.
Those are not the same thing. Whether she's not hooking now or not a hooker, but
well, either way,
okay.
But she's walking to the casino to meet with her boyfriend. 2 a.m. He's waiting for her at the restaurant, and just outside the restaurant, she and her friend are waylaid by a vice sweep and taken and held for 2 hours. The court originally dismissed the casino, saying that the casino was following the directions of the police officers and therefore were essentially immune. That has now been reversed, and the case is currently going forward against both the police and the casino.
So that's the current status of it.
Yeah, that's the current status. And I've just told you what the complaint says. They've got defenses that they're trying to raise. One of them that I find really curious that they keep harping on is this was an area of known prostitution. At the deposition, they acknowledged that not only is that casino and that casino floor, but the entire area from, what was the question I asked? I believe from Russell to Desert Inn on the Las Vegas Strip and all the casinos on it are an area of known prostitution. And if you extrapolate from what the police officers said, they then feel that they have a right to take any woman into custody along that line of the Las Vegas Boulevard because they are walking in an area of known prostitution.
No guy hookers? I mean, why do women get all the fun here?
I think guy hookers are a myth, but that's just my opinion again. I have no...
they have that Showtime show, that whole thing looks fake.
Yeah, we're buying reality TV, Rich?
No.
We're digressing again. structuring, where there are rules about cashing out 10,000 or more at a time, and so players might have more and want to get around the rules, sort of, but legally. We mentioned this a couple times ago, and you said maybe next time.
Well, I'm trying to research my way through this, and my personal opinions from what I've looked at are even more restrictive than what the government currently imposes on defines structuring as. First understand, I believe money's fungible, okay? And this whole idea of money laundering and tracking it and CTRs and all of that other stuff is more Big Brother than actually trying to stop any kind of crime. But the law says that if you do a cash transaction of more than $10,000, you have to report it, or it has to be reported by certain financial institutions, of which casinos are included, and that they also have to report what they believe are structured transactions, which are cash, one big cash transaction made in a lot of little cash transactions to avoid the CTR system. And then on top of that, if you are structuring to avoid a CTR, that would make you a criminal as well. I think it's as simple as this, and this is where I'm more restrictive than the government. If you have $20,000 and you want to, if you have $20,000 in chips all at one time, and you want to undertake a cash transaction where you get 20 grand back, if you give them $5,000 over 4 days, that would be structuring to me, the way the law is written. But the regulations and stuff behind it have essentially said that, more than $10,000 in a 24-hour period, and then they break the 24-hour period at midnight so that if you cash 8 at 11:58 and 8 at midnight plus 2 minutes, you have successfully avoided the CTR issue. I just stay away from it completely and don't structure.
Well, but if you have 20,000, how do you not structure if you don't want to give your
idea?
Why are
you so worried about it?
Because if you give them an ID with your name on it, you'll get barred.
Be a refusal and give them your social security number. Or you might get barred too, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, but wait a minute. You might get barred because they know your name.
Yeah, once they know your name, you're not going to be able to play there anymore.
Because you're famous.
Or you're in OSN or Griffin or...
If you're not, just go cash the damn money. All right.
Yeah, if you're not.
But there are players who have
those kind of funds. Most of them are in Griffin and OSN and all the databases, you know.
Okay.
But I mean, in my case, I don't structure because I don't cash anything out. If I have $20,000 in chips, I get up and walk out the door. I never cash out after I play.
I understand.
So,
how many chips do you have at your house?
Yeah, that was a little bit risky on the radio. They're not at his house. I know for a fact.
Well, then later I may go out to lunch and take a few thousand with me to cash out, you know, before lunch. But
okay, careful what you're saying.
Yeah.
All right. We just had a structured lunch here. All right. Good. So It's always a pleasure to have you on, Bob. We hope to have you on again.
You're done talking to me with 15 minutes to go?
Well, we do have some other things to talk about. We can go back to...
We may come back after commercials.
Yeah. We still haven't answered a question about taping a casino security guard when he's giving you a hard time. We didn't really address that.
If he's giving you... I'd love it if you did it. As long as you do it openly. Don't try to do it surreptitiously.
Right, just tell him you're recording it.
Or just show him you are by pulling out your phone and pointing it in his face and going, leave me alone, leave me alone, leave me alone.
And if he didn't tell you to take that and shove it where the sun don't shine, then, of course, if
you
he
don't
did,
have to listen to him. He's not your father.
Now, I will.
He has a lot of big friends.
I would point, this goes back to the, well, now I'm going to be barred. Well, probably if you're already in a situation where you're worrying about filming it, you're going to be put out anyway. What's the difference if you're put out over a phone or over the fact that you did something to tick him off earlier? I don't know.
As an attorney, would you be happy if your client had this taped evidence when he came
in? I would love it. In fact, I have had that taped evidence where the security guard literally reached out and grabbed the phone. And I had a picture of a giant hand coming over the video, and that sang like nothing else in settlement discussions. I mean, that case went down real well, real easy.
Good thing it wasn't an Indian casino. It wouldn't have gone down as well.
Right.
All good. All right. So, Munch, what did we learn tonight?
We learned not to structure.
We learned not to structure or not to admit it on the radio.
Not to be a girl walking in between Russell and Desert Inn Road on the Las Vegas Strip. You'll be arrested as a hooker.
For those not familiar with Las Vegas, that's a big area.
Yeah, that's basically from Mandalay all the way to the Wynn. So.
Yeah, all right, good. So are there any women in that area?
Yeah.
All right, good. So let's talk about our sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. During the month, there'll be $400,000 March Money Madness Progressive. The Progressive starts at $10,000 and continues upward 24/7 until it hits sometime before $25,000, where it'll be randomly awarded to any active slot club player, which includes video poker players. Every player playing when the jackpot is awarded receives $25 in free play, unless, of course, he was the one who got the jackpot. Immediately thereafter, another jackpot begins at $10,000 and starts to climb. In terms of double points, we've been predicting on the show that Palm Sunday and or Easter Sunday will be awarded double points. Turns out we were right about Easter and wrong about Palm Sunday. But on Easter Sunday, double points. This past Sunday, St. Patrick's Day, was also double points, and the March Money Madness went off at least three separate times. Presumably, it's going to do that on Easter Sunday as well. So this is a freebie extra reason to play on a day where it makes sense to play anyway. The free video poker class beginning this Tuesday at noon will be double bonus deuces wild. This is a 99.81% game. And it'll be the third and last of our Deuces Wild variations that we're teaching this semester. The more of these strategies you can learn, the more you'll learn how strategy changes when the pay schedule changes. Although I don't recommend it, most players occasionally find themselves a game that they haven't studied in depth. And the more you understand the general principles of how pay schedule categories and strategies are involved, the better you do when you are winging it on these machines. At the Palms, every weekend in March, the Palms is giving away a 2013 Volkswagen Jetta car. The car is worth about $18,000, and you can receive $15,000 in cash or free play if you prefer that. You earn drawing tickets, and on both Friday and Saturday nights, there'll be 10 people who get keys to the car and along with $500, and after the drawing on Saturday, all 20 of those people will see how their car works. They'll either end up with the car or between $1 and $400. Playing, you get three times drawing tickets Friday and Saturday between 8 and midnight. As I wrote in my recent blog last week, I played heavily, lost the bundle, got called twice in the drawing, didn't win the car. I'm not playing this week, but I will be playing next week, being a slow learner about losing a bundle. But anyway, I still think it's a good bet, and I'll be playing a lot starting Saturday at 8 p.m. The Play, Earn, and Win gifts for the last half of the month will have a theme of Light Up My Life, where the top prize is a $100 gift card to Lowe's Hardware. You can also earn fake fireplace, flashlights, Tiffany lamps, among other gifts. At videopoker.com, the monthly contest in March, beginning this coming Sunday at noon Pacific, is the game Deal Draw Poker. This is a relatively new game, and it's a variation on double pay, where you get paid on the deal and paid on the draw. The rate you get paid on the deal is slightly better than what you get paid on the draw. So if the game starts out at 99.2, the combined game will be something like 99.3 or 99.4. And of course, even if you're a bad player on the part, on the draw part, the machine's going to play perfectly on the deal part, so you'll do better than the game itself. Next week, we're going to have one of two guests. Now, they're both going to be on in the near future, but it's not quite official as to who will be on when. One of these is Mark Billings. Mark was on the show a few months ago talking about biased wheels and roulette. This time he'll be talking about his book, The Ultimate Edge, which was about playing blackjack in the 1980s. In the 80s, my personal best game was backgammon, and although I did do some studying of blackjack, my personal best blackjack days were in the early 90s. This book is basically about four guys, and I came away feeling that if there had been a little different fluctuation in my life, I might have been one of those four guys, although I'm not quite sure which one. I like the book and learned a lot by reading it. Munch, I suspect you know the real guys behind these four characters. Did you enjoy the book as well?
I loved the book, actually, because I recognized the guys immediately when I started reading it, and they lived in an apartment complex right behind mine. And, you know, Vegas, the card counting community was very small in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. And so all the teams really kind of knew each other. He talks a lot in the book about them developing a shuffle tracking computer and their experiences using that. Computers were legal back then. And, you know, my first foreign trip was with a friend using a shuffle tracking computer. And so a lot of it just, I really related to a lot of it. So should be a good interview.
Yeah. And our second possible guest is Kathy Hulbert. She's a blackjack and poker player and was profiled in Munchkin's book, Gambling Wizards. I met her for the first time about a month ago. Kathy's a handful. I thought she was very charming. Now, what can you tell us about Kathy?
You know, I thought Kathy was actually the most interesting interview in my book. I thought, first of all, she has the perspective of being a woman in those two fields that are, you know, dominated by men. And also her perspective on the difference between blackjack players and poker players. There's a, you know, they're really very different types of advantage gamblers.
Agreed.
So yeah, she's a pretty wild girl, and she'll be a lot of fun.
She will be. Now, whoever we have next week, probably in 2 weeks, we'll have former co-host Michael Shackelford. Shack recently took a trip to Costa Rica. And he'll share with us about the gambling scene there. And he's also been studying advantage bingo and wants to talk about that as well. Should be interesting.
We all are getting older, so that's our future.
Is advantage bingo part of your repertoire? Are you a whole carder in bingo?
I think I got about another 30 years before I start trying to go after advantage bingo.
I don't know. I have done it. I have done well in advantage bingo.
Really?
Yeah, oh. I have. Although with a different set of rules that do not exist anymore. Oh. So that'll be Shackelford. And so we'll post somewhere. And who's going to be on. So good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.